Overture, played on that recording by the Danish National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 7:30. Time now to return live to the Royal Albert Hall for our second prom this Sunday. It's presented by Martin Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Yes, welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's second BBC prom, in which the BBC Symphony Orchestra is joined by pianist Louis Lawty and its conductor laureate Sir Andrew Davis. The concert has two pairs of works in a structure which Andrew Davis came up with, based on the symphony which ends the programme.
The starting point was the Brahms 4, and I was asked if I'd do some Parry, and we looked at various things, and then I thought, well, there's this piece called Elegy for Brahms, let me have a look at it. And I rather liked it, so it seemed a very nice pairing. And then we talked about Mozart Piano Concerto for the first half with Louis, who I'm delighted to be working with. I first worked with him in 1978 when he was 18. Then I had this idea of Messiaen's Mozart piece, Un Sourire. So we've got Parry's Brahms piece and Messiaen's Mozart piece before their respective idols, so to speak. And I've never done Un Sourire before, I never conducted it, but I've always loved it. It's a very naive, kind of sweet, simple piece. You might say it's almost formulaic for Messiaen. It has, you know, the slow, beautiful music interspersed with birdsong. But that's what Messiaen did so beautifully. And it has an atmosphere that I find absolutely irresistible.
Well, Messiaen's own words sum up his piece. Despite all his sorrows and sufferings, hunger, cold, incomprehension and closeness to death, Mozart never stopped smiling. His music smiles too. So I allowed myself in all humility to call my homage Un Sourire, a smile. And here is Stephen Bryant, leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Followed onto the platform at the Royal Albert Hall by Sir Andrew Davis. To conduct Messiaen's Un Sourire. A radiant chord on wind and strings, even sounding like a Mozart chord, and in that key of A major, which Mozart used for his most radiant music. It ends Messiaen's homage to him, Un Sourire, a smile, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to open tonight's BBC From, live on Radio 3 by the BBC Symphony Orchestra with its conductor laureate, Andrew Davis. The last commission the octogenarian Messiaen fulfilled, first performed in Paris, 5th of December 1991, the exact bicentenary of Mozart's death. But after that piece, it really has to be Mozart to follow. And what could be more smiling than his Piano Concerto No. 17 in G, Kirkel 453, in which the soloist is Louis Lorty. And to get to that music, the piano has to be moved across the stage. Conductor and pianist have worked together for a long time, and I reminded Louis that Andrew had given him his big break.
Absolutely. He was planning to hold auditions for the Toronto Symphony, and he was music director at the time. And somebody told him about me that I should be in his list of pianists to listen to, but I was so young, nobody knew about me. I think when I played for him, I was probably 17 or something like that. So they called me and they flew me in to Toronto and I played an excerpt of something. And I think he wanted the Liszt Piano Concerto for the tour and I had it under my finger. So I played it and there it was. He wanted me for the tour. And of course, I was very impressed to be around all these great musicians. It was a wonderful tour with the late Maureen Forrester, who just died recently. So it brings back a lot of memories.
Is Mozart central to your musical world?
Yes, and of course, one of the things that has changed for me a lot is with the years I've started to conduct it from the keyboard. So it is, of course, a little more problematic when you've had that experience after that. I mean, just the fact that the musicians in the back don't know if they are really following you well or not, because when you play it with a smaller orchestra circling your instrument, it's different. Everybody hears what you are doing. There's no piano lid, there's nothing. So it's a more risky experience with a conductor because of the piano lid and the relay thing between the soloist and the winds in the back, especially in a piece like this one, 4-5-3, where the winds are so involved, and I'm sure they would like to be just next to the keyboard to know exactly what's going on. But this is a tradition that we've kept, and probably at the Albert Hall might also be a bit problematic. It's totally at the extremes with the Royal Albert Hall.
You've mentioned the wonderful wind writing and these duets, these conversations with the piano. There's a very operatic feel to a lot of this.
Oh, totally, absolutely. And then there's a lot of repartee, you know, between... And it happens very, very, very quickly, very often. That's why it's so important that everybody can hear the others, because it happens so quickly. I mean, if you miss just a little difference in the intervention of the others, because the fun about it is to do those give and takes differently all the time, keep them fresh. Especially in the last finale, which is a little bit like a quartet at the end of an opera. And so you have to keep it fresh and keep the humour very much alive.
The programme begins with Messiaen's homage, Un Sourire. Is this concerto the smiling Mozart?
You know what Mozart is. It's smiling and it's also very, very tragic because the slow movement, the inner part of it, is very tragic, but in a very baroque manner. It's opera. It's able to change the mood at once, you know. It can just go from the most dark feeling to the warmest and easiest one very, very, very quickly. It's amazing that he can do that. Maybe because there is also this easiness of conversation between all the parts. It speaks, maybe more than ever in the earlier Mozart concertos, because so many of the instruments in the orchestra, especially the winds, are coming in as single personas, and that really changes the whole dialogue and makes it also able to shift abruptly in the mood as it would be with a real text in an opera.
Louis Lorty. The pianist in the first performance of the concerto was one of Mozart's favourite pupils, the 19-year-old Barbara Babette Ployer, a niece of the Viennese agent of his erstwhile loathed employer, the Prince Archbishop of Salzburg. And the concerto was premiered at a concert in which master and pupil each took on solo roles and then joined together for his two piano sonata. Mozart wrote the G major concerto as the last of a group of three he completed in just a couple of months in the spring of 1784. It was a time when he was flavour of the day in Vienna and when to sponsor the talented pianist composer was the fashionable thing to do, just as agent Ployer did among almost 200 individuals. Babette Ployer gave that first performance in the family home in the Viennese suburbs. So this is music written for small forces in domestic surroundings, subtle chamber music rather than grandiose public statement, with a particularly prominent role in the texture, as Louis Lorty said, for the small group of wind players, flute and pairs of oboes, bassoons and horns. And it still feels like very personal music, even though Mozart didn't write this one to play himself. Colourful, complex, particularly in the opening movement, full of harmonic twists, chromatic shifts and modulations. A wide variety of musical ideas, from theatrical to whimsical, discussed by piano and orchestra. Wonderfully rich central slow movement, and the finale, a set of variations on a charmingly bouncy folk-like tune. After five very contrasting variations, Mozart racks up the tempo for that toe-tapping final faster section like an operatic aria. Well, tonight's soloist Louis Lawty is now making his way onto the Albert Hall platform, followed by Andrew Davis, and they are joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra to perform Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 17 in G.
Thank you.
dazzling end to Mozart's Piano Concerto number 17 in G, Kirkel 453, played here in the Royal Albert Hall by the mercurial Louis Lawty with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and its conductor laureate Andrew Davis. And apparently the tune which Mozart used, the basis for the variations of the finale, is one he noted down as being sung by his pet starling. A detail that would have made Messiaen, whose homage to Mozart began this evening's prom, smile too. Well, I must mention the three particular wind soloists, the flautist Michael Cox, oboist Richard Simpson, and bassoonist Julie Price, who contributed so much to that performance, to their dialogue with Louis Lawty, whose first performance appearance was 24 years ago, also playing a Mozart concerto, the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, under its then music director, one Andrew Davis. Louis Lawty back on the platform, broad beam, big embrace for Andrew Davis the minute they finished. Louis Lawty rather more used to doing it on his own, really. He's just done a cycle of concertos with the Montreal Symphony, directing from the piano. He was struggling not to conduct, and the wind being brought to their feet. Huge applause for them. Louis Lawty's broken off from his holidays to play tonight. He's setting up a new little home on the shores of Lake Como, a dream since he won the Busoni competition in Italy many years ago. One of his main works next season, the Brahms Second Piano Concerto. He wants to let his interpretation coagulate, he said, before playing it with the Leipzig Commandos Orchestra and Kurt Mazur. Well, after the interval, the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Sir Andrew Davis perform another pair of works when Brahms's greatest orchestral triumph, his fourth symphony, is preceded by the first performance at the proms of the elegy Hubert Parry wrote when he heard of his hero Brahms's death. But before that, for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, we continue our series of talks on My Summer Job. In the novelist A.L. Kennedy's case, it was very much within the family and enabled her to get to know her grandparents at close quarters.
It's 4 a.m. Later, when I'm an adult, I will meet 4 a.m. quite often. But for now, it's new. Horrible and new. It hurts. All over. My grandparents have, of course, already been awake for at least an hour. They are washed and dressed. My grandmother is drinking tea and eating toasted rounds of milk loaf, a type of bread I only ever see when I am in their house. And my grandfather, having woken me, is in the kitchen, soft-footed in his slippers, and gathering more tea, and more kept warm and already buttered, and therefore soft and salt, and uniquely my grandfather's kind of toast, for me. My body accepts both as additional affronts to its systems. The pair of them look at me while I eat, grinning, and in general not very secretly pleased. I have finally joined them in their world of stealing a march on everyone, of afternoon naps and early to bed, and then up and ready and off to work before the day can catch them. I try to appear nonchalant. And I am sort of, in a way, enjoying this. I love the smell of my grandfather's work jacket and his overalls. Dark, sharp scents of metals and grease and Swarfiger. They are part of the huge, dependable, secretive, funny, gentlemanly, tender, and strangely graceful thing which is my grandfather. But today, and every other weekday for the whole of the holidays, I will be working with my grandmother. I will be getting to know my grandmother. My prickly, changeable, wiry grandmother, an occasionally foul-tempered and violent pacifist, an old-style red flag socialist married to a One Nation Tory, a woman with the loudest laugh in any theatre, a woman who hated crudity but loved a naughty joke, and who refused to receive communion for years because she believed she was too full of sin to deserve it. Eventually the vicar had to go round and explain. My grandmother was a whole crowd of tricky people to spend time with. She gave me a peppermint on the bus. No journey of any kind being survivable without sandwiches or at least a boiled sweet, and I was meanwhile amazed that there even was a bus, and that it was almost full of other people, in overalls and anoraks and safety boots and caps, people prepared and equipped to do things. Only child of a teacher and a university professor, of two people who had educated themselves away from all of this, I didn't know about going to work in the dark. I was 13. My parents were newly divorced, and I now lived in a different place, a small flat in my hometown on the northeast coast of Scotland. Things were altered, but also the same. From the top of our street, I could still see the river with fields beyond. But this was Staffordshire, the Black Country. And not just for flying visits at Easter with relatives coming round. This was weeks and weeks of staying with my grandparents, of starting to meet where they lived, where they came from. This was steel mills and forges and car building and fish and chips and potato scallops on a Friday and keeping money in tins under the bed and fabricating and turning and extrusion moulding and clay pits and subsiding long-forgotten mines and riveting and welding and canals. This was a heritage of manufacturing that had turned a whole county the colour of coal dust, of soot, of the dirt of making things that Britain needed, that its empire had needed. Guns and locks and manacles for the slave trade. Even its air tasted metallic, questionable. It could seem a dark place of injuries and cripplings, of harms. And people still told the story of Queen Victoria passing through in her royal train and just closing her blinds on the Black Country, ignoring it until it went away. They still bore a grudge, on behalf of a hard and proud, ingenious and partly crazy place, where chimneys were chimbleys, and your throat was your thrapple, and if you were a fool you weren't, you were a wazzock. And heaven help you if my grandmother thought you were a wazzock, because the very least she'd do would be to tell you. It was all, of course, doomed, although I didn't know about that either. Staffordshire's industries were ailing even then, and it was getting scared, small-minded, fretting over immigration, while the next generations, wherever they came from, lost their accents, spoke all-purpose, homogenised Brummy. The words that my grandmother used became peculiar before being turned out to silence. But that first morning, the quiet, tired-looking people doggedly boarded and left our bus, and the rain fell, and we drove away from streets and houses, through into haphazard modern industrial estates, and then further, back into somewhere impossible, somewhere in the past. When we climbed down and started to walk, there was Staffordshire blue brick shining all around us, a vaguely iridescent purple on the walls, and even underfoot, worn into smooth hollows. And my grandmother led the way through a complex of Victorian alleys and courtyards and small windowed structures, and past hand-painted signs that might have referred to businesses long gone. And finally, we halted at the nondescript door of a shabby, low building, to which she had the key. She let us in, proprietorial and swift, and then she turned on the lights, and there it was, the cabinet maker's workshop, at our disposal. Stacked wood, and racked wood, and aging wood, and new wood, and old wood, wood organised and categorised in ways I couldn't comprehend, and wounded furniture held in clamps, and half-finished new items of various designs and monumental crouching machines, their bits and blades sleeping, but all of them clearly quite capable of lopping or dicing or gouging or massively sawing a person in two. The detail of their edges, in fact, more plainly worrying when at rest. And above all else, there was, naturally, overpoweringly, wonderfully, the smell of wood. The dusty, sweet, comforting and homely smell of wood. A solid atmosphere of so much wood, of so many types, that each step inside it would be slightly different. Would bring the cheap whip and spring of young pine, or the dry and intelligent complications of restored mahogany, the sharp density of beech, the melancholy heat in oak, and the further tastes and traces of grains and curves and knots and flaws, of flexibilities and qualities and names I didn't know. It was magnificent. And my grandmother understood it. She was both its mistress and its master. Inside the workshop, she became stiller, taller, more assured. A woman it was impossible not to admire. Not that she was literally still, not at all. She arrived so ludicrously early because before she could start working, there was work to do. Because what is a cabinet maker's full of, besides wood and the sense of wood? Mess. And what could my grandmother not abide? Mess. And indeed, messing. And, now that you mention it, not that you ever should, people who messed. And on every surface of the workshop, even on the walls and in the air, there was mess. An artisan, a professional, like my grandmother, knows how to be in dirty places without losing her dignity, knows how to be a credit to her craft. And what was her craft? French polishing. And all the allied arts and tricks and mysteries of staining, varnishing, colouring, spraying, and lacquering, of hiding faults, revealing beauties, of renewing and creating surfaces. And she was good. She was the real thing. Although initially more by accident than choice. Her mother had put her into service and, always awkward, independent, she'd walked out at lunchtime on her first day. Her employers had given her potatoes to peel for their lunch and some others for herself, the others being, as she said, not fit for pigs, and so she had told them at the time, and had then been punished with an apprenticeship to a French polisher. A strange job. A man's job. One which condemned its practitioners to early deaths. So many toxic fumes and substances. The risk of fire. And in the days before health and safety, before cheap and effective compressors and guns, French polishers had to take mouthfuls of meths, of thinners, and spray them out through their teeth, this leading to almost inevitable professional intoxication and addiction. But my grandmother survived. She learned. She excelled. She even took on custom jobs, all of the handrails in a Welsh university once. An awful lot of effort, but satisfying. Or the teak on a fancy boat. Or some celebrity who wanted her speakers to match her piano. High-gloss black lacquer over shoddy chipboard and veneer. Something both difficult and offensive about the request. And still, she fulfilled it. She pulled it off. But what she loved, of course, was proper wood and proper finishes. They were her obsession. She would stalk round other people's homes, running her big, hard, leathery hands over their sideboards and tables and cupboards, loudly finding fault. The world was full of second-rate rubbish, of bad fakery, of good wood spoiled, of messing, but not in her workshop, in her own corner within the wider workshop, never there. Not in her special room with its broad tables carefully covered in clean sheets from the Financial Times, with the spray guns hung up in good order and the extractor hood ready, caked in years of accumulated vapours that had formed a crust like yellowish, poisonous snow. And here too were her bottles and bottles of special secret mixtures, polishes and stains, with their sour, clever breath. And her immaculate cloths and wadding that she would make up into pads for laying on the French polish, in delicate coat after coat, smoothing down a suspension of beetle's wings. Insanely temperamental, wonderfully lovely, the heart of her craft. And on the walls about her were colour charts of brown, and brown, and brown. Whole panels set out in neat squares of what I could only see as exactly the same shade of brown. But for her, they were different. For her, they were unmistakably only themselves, and only a Wazzeck couldn't see it. And there were Wazzecks on all sides. Like the man who tried to bring in pieces for her that hadn't been sanded to a frictionless glide. They might set down, say, a table, and before they could escape, grown men scurrying like kids, she'd have swiped down one of her paws across its top and let out something between a groan and a scream, and then would come the tirade, the blistering, diminishing abuse of all they were and ever could be, and no, don't take it away, she would do it herself. And sure enough, she would take up the glass paper and smooth until all was well. And this was my grandmother. This man-destroying tyrant. This magnificent perfectionist with untireable arms and unfathomable ways of seeing. On that initial day, after crunchy bacon sandwiches from the faraway Cominor canteen, she began to introduce me to her skills, to show me her patience, her delicacy, her confidence. And she'd never taken an apprentice, because no one was good enough. Not for her recipes, for her discipline, for the glory of what she could do. But I was her only granddaughter, and I truly did love wood. And I was taking an interest. And while she worked, our awkwardness and jangled nerves and silences fell away as she explained things, and yet I was hopeless. Let loose on offcuts with the spray gun, I produced only ugly runs and trails and gummy horror. I was unable to learn. I liked to sand. Surely it wouldn't take a genius to sand. But I couldn't feel the subtle lines of things, how sharp corners must stay sharp, how horizontals must stay absolute, constant. And in any case, I got too tired too quickly. And my French polishing, even with the easiest mixture, I could feel its hackles rising under my pad, outraged as I slathered it on all wrong. And I would smooth it back with meths, almost wash it away with meths, and try another pass, and then all would become just as sticky and dreadful as before, and on it would go, never improving. But somehow, she didn't shout at me, didn't rant, only smiled, because yes, it was so very difficult. And she would make up another pad, and we would try again. In the end, I was consigned to making up the cardboard lattices they sometimes used to pack round items for shipping, or to whittling away at offcuts. I was company for her. I was the reason that for the whole of that summer, no one in the workshop could ever, ever swear on pain of her displeasure. But I was no apprentice. And I was already heading somewhere else, off into books and writing, towards a different craft, one that my grandparents held in a kind of superstitious respect. They suspected it would lead to dark moods and complications and long walks in bad weather, which it did, and eye strain and spectacles, which it didn't. Eventually, my grandmother told me that she wouldn't be giving me her special recipe for polish because it could only have been for me if I was serious about the work. But she did give me a bottle of her mixture, a dark brown mystery. Unstoppered, it smelt enjoyably bitter and alert. And I did use it, did painstakingly polish a pair of old wooden shuttles, relics of my hometown's industrial past. And in the end, they didn't look too bad. And in the end, she was proud of what I did. She lived long enough to see the start of my being published, to talk about it endlessly to relatives and strangers. And she could read the story I wrote about her and the potatoes, and losing one job and finding another. And then my grandfather could show it to people at her funeral, still helpless with her loss, pressing the magazine into the vicar's hands, because this would be the kind of thing a vicar would understand, and was proof of her, was something still there. No one explained to me until she was long gone that her first husband, the one I never met, had died soon after their wedding. One day, so much in love that they were each other, had the same haircut, wore suits cut from the same cloth, and then a corpse beside her, waking to a corpse, and what we would now call a nervous breakdown. They'd have to sit her on a chair in the street if the house was empty, so horrified was she by being alone. And a new husband, younger, an athlete, a man who would and did outlive her, but always the dreams of her first love, of Jack Peace, not Joe Price. And always she would tell my grandfather in the morning, I dreamed of Jack, and he would bear it. And the tantrums, and the screaming, and the rages that blew up from nowhere and then evaporated. He bore it all, while she doted on him in her strange, harsh, passionate way. They were together more than 40 years. I'm the same build as my grandmother. I look much the same as she did at my age. Another unwomanly, angular perfectionist. And maybe she helped to make me self-employed, to keep my own hours, and to always own my workplace, not just borrow it in the small hours. And my house is full of wood, of finishes and waxes and grains. Only one thing in the place is French polished, a table. I did it myself, and thought of her shaking her head at me all the while.
My summer job with Grandma in the Woodwork Shop was written and presented by A.L. Kennedy and produced by Mark Smalley. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, and to tonight's BBC Prom live on Radio 3. This is already the BBC Symphony Orchestra's fifth concert this season, but the first to which the orchestra has been able to welcome back its conductor laureate, Andrew Davis. The main work in the second half is Brahms' magnificently defiant Fourth Symphony. Before it, though, we hear the first performance at the BBC Proms of the elegy Hubert Parry wrote on hearing of Brahms's death. Parry, like Elgar, didn't really look like a composer, perhaps a military man with a nautical jauntiness. He did like sailing boats, but anyway, he looked like someone rather conventional. Actually, he was naturally unconventional. And as Parry expert Jeremy Dibble and Parry's great-granddaughter Laura Ponsonby told me earlier at the Proms intro over the road at the Royal College of Music.
He was crazy. He played all these extremely dangerous sports. I mean, often he was laid up at Eton, you know, knocked unconscious during these games of fives or whatever they play. And, I mean, he played everything, absolutely put his back into whatever he did. Of course, this is the story of his life, really. Mm. But yes, he was a keen sportsman. I mean, even later in his life, he used to like to go to the varsity matches, cricket, rugby. And so on, yeah.
But he did things like sort of sailing his yacht in a storm and then jumping off it.
Yes, he did. That's absolutely right. He only liked his yacht if it was really stormy. Anything he did, I know my grandmother, who was devoted to him, said he, you know, even a car drive, he preferred it when the weather was terrible. Mm. And I know he said about one of his trips on the yacht, it was calm, we had no fun at all.
Hubert Parry's granddaughter, great-granddaughter, I should say, Laura Ponsonby. And his affinity with gloomy weather ran deep. His daughter also said that some days his whole being would become clouded as if he was battling with some deep inner pain. Vaughan Williams was a pupil. He recalled Parry as having a very nervous temperament. Also, he was, from his early days right down to the end of his life, a very deep thinker, both on music and on other subjects, so said VW. Parry admired Brahms more than any other composer, perhaps because of the musical restraint he saw in him he would like to have had himself. And Brahms' death, a huge blow to Parry. As director of the Royal College of Music, he addressed the students about Brahms' importance, not just as a musician, but as someone who he regarded as sincere, honest individual and full of personal conviction. The grief-stricken Parry freed himself of his other commitments so he could compose a piece in Brahms' memory, but try as he might, he couldn't finish it by the day of the commemoration concert at the college. Maybe it was more of a private tribute anyway, so it was perhaps appropriate it was first played at Parry's own memorial concert after his death in 1918, when his colleague and erstwhile rival Stanford took the score down from Parry's shelves and revised it for performance. It may be called elegy, but it's not only a very personal, but a very passionate expression of feeling. Moments which recall Brahms, but almost as many which are Wagnerian, the two great opposing musical figures of the day exerting an equal influence on Parry's psyche. So now here once again comes Andrew Davies to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Parry's Elegy for Brahms. mystical resolution at the end of Parry's Elegy for Brahms, which has just been given its first performance at the BBC Proms by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. Somehow appropriate that it was played for Parry himself at the memorial concert for him, in a sense, original, passionate, brooding. Well, to end tonight's BBC Prom, music by the man Parry so revered, Brahms. And Parry would surely have been overwhelmed by Brahms' Fourth Symphony. Andrew Davis likes it too.
It is my favourite Brahms symphony. I know we're all conductors are supposed to say their favourite Brahms symphony. There's one they're conducting at the moment, but I have to say Brahms 4 is my favourite.
Well, Brahms kept his symphony secret from even his closest friends while he was composing it. And after he'd finished it, he wrote to one of them, "Shall I send you a piece of a piece of me, and have you the time to look at it and report? In general, pieces by me are unfortunately more pleasant than I am myself and require less correction. But in this area, the cherries do not grow ripe and sweet to the taste. If you do not like the thing, do not hesitate to say so. I'm not anxious to write a bad number 4. Brahms made the same rather disparaging comments when he was trying to persuade his friend Hans von Bülow to let him give the first performance with his orchestra in Meiningen. Despite the rather strange selling technique, he also suggested the symphony wouldn't get much of an audience. Von Bülow gave Brahms the go-ahead and returned from listening to a rehearsal to note, "Number 4, stupendous, quite original, quite new, individual and rock-like, breathes incomparable energy from start to finish." And some years earlier, Brahms had discussed with von Bülow the idea of a symphonic movement based on a version of the Chaconne in Bach's Cantata 150. In his Fourth Symphony, Brahms uses the theme as the basis for his Passacaglia with 32 variations, which forms the arresting tragic finale. And before it comes Brahms' only symphonic scherzo, a movement with enough energy and power to function as a finale itself. Can't help feeling that Hubert Parry would have liked it, that this first Proms performance of his Elegy for Brahms, the Fourth Symphony by the great man, was played after it. And here comes Andrew Davis once again to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Brahms' Fourth Symphony.
Thank you.
Brahms' Fourth Symphony, ending with defiant magnificence, music full of power, lyricism and compassion. Played to end is BBC Brahm by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Stephen Bryant, and conducted by its conductor laureate, Sir Andrew Davis. Some of Brahms' friends may have had their doubts about the piece, but when they first heard it in a two-piano version and the composer conducted its first performance in Meiningen and took it on tour, it was very warmly received. Only in Vienna were there problems. Some of the reviews were extremely hostile. It was only a few weeks before Brahms' death when a performance finally won the Viennese round and became the focus of a great outpouring of affection for him, his last appearance in public. Andrew Davis back on the platform, bringing the woodwinds to their feet, led by flautist Michael Cox, oboist Richard Simpson, clarinetist Catherine Lacey, bassoonist Julie Price. And that was for the horns, principal horn Martin Owen. And the brass going to their feet. Huge roar, principal percussionist, principal timpanist, I should say, John Chimes. And the strings. Well, don't forget, if you've missed some of tonight's prom, or would like to listen again, you can always do so. Just go to the website, bbc.co.uk/radio3, select proms, and pick prom 31, and it'll be broadcast again on Radio 3 next Friday afternoon at 2. Tomorrow's a double prom day, triple if you include lunchtime at the Cadogan Hall. First one starts at 7, first evening concert gives you the chance to compare youth orchestras. After the National Youth Orchestra Symphonie Fantastique yesterday evening, tomorrow the European Union Youth Orchestra Matthias Bammert tackle more Berlioz. Also on the programme, Tchaikovsky and Janacek. And in 10 in the late night prom, the BBC Radio 3 World Roots Academy in Music from Iraq. So another very full day at the BBC Proms, all live here on Radio 3. But for the moment, as Andrew Davis returns to the platform here in the Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House for the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. Well, in 13 minutes' time tonight, our Sunday feature, After a Dance Maker Dies. With the deaths over the past years of choreographers Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch, the Sunday feature asks whether modern dances can and should survive the deaths of their makers. That's at 10 o'clock tonight. Until then, following on from the finale of Brahms' Fourth Symphony, a little more music inspired by Bach. Few musicians forge a link in people's minds with one work more than pianist Tatiana Nikolaeva did with the Shostakovich Preludes and Fugues for piano. It was Nikolaeva's playing of Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues which inspired Shostakovich to write his own set. He only went round the keys once, 24 to Bach's 48, but what an extraordinary tribute they are. As Nikolaeva put it herself, a new word in polyphony. She'd been then at the start of the tribute in early 1950s Moscow when she was in her 20s. She went round to Shostakovich's flat every day. There was another prelude and fugue, she said, and they worked on them together. Well, here she is recorded in 1990 in number 16 in B-flat minor. Thank you. Shostakovich, inspired by Bach. Number 16 in B-flat minor from Shostakovich's 24 Preludes and Fugues, played there by the Russian Tatiana Nikolaeva. It's 10 o'clock and now on BBC Radio 3, the Sunday feature. Last summer, two important modern choreographers died. Both were modern dance makers who'd been hailed as pioneers and great artists, but now their works and their companies hang on threads. Francis Burns asks, can a modern dance work survive the death of its maker in After a Dance Maker Dies?
So these are the notes for Pictures, which was my first dance. Yeah.
Someone's reading a dance.
LIF walks, number 30. So Lise Friedman, those are her initials, is walking in, doing phrase number 30. AG, that's Alan Good, is walking at the same time as her. He's doing phrase number 21. I remember the piece so well. So phrase number 30 is a slow walk in releve fourth, and Alan's phrase was a walk on flat foot.
But this logbook of stick men and shorthand is a choreographer's notebook. It isn't the dance itself. No score or script can give us a dance.
I was the new person in the company at the time, so it would be a while. Here I am. PL, step on left.
Merce Cunningham said, you have to love dancing to stick to it. It gives you nothing back. No manuscripts to store away, no paintings to show on walls and maybe hang in museums, no poems to be printed and sold, nothing but that fleeting moment when you feel alive. Last summer, after 90 years of life, during which he'd made about 200 dances and been called a genius, he died in New York. The fleeting moment over, can his masterwork survive? Twenty-seven days before Merce, another seminal dancemaker had died, suddenly in Wuppertal, in Germany, Pina Bausch.
I never considered going to see Merce Cunningham's grave in New York. There's something here that really suits Pina. A grave overlooking a pond in the woods, which is all smoky. And moving. And of course, beside me, her changing body.
Both Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch made original worlds out of movement. I'd say Merce was of the air and Pina of the earth. The work of Cunningham is like lines that light makes in water. Pina's dancers get drenched or quenched or reborn in it. Most dance works have been lost. Of course, flimsy things disintegrate, superficial works cloy, earnest things bore. But what about the most revelatory of our modern dancers? Surely dancegoers who thrive on a sense of possibility and loss, always in hope of the numinous moment, do want another few seasons of Biped, Summer Space, Beach Birds, Nelken, Bausch's Rite of Spring, before they join the long list of the lost or, like Nijinsky's Rite of Spring, myth.
Dance is an activity. Unless it's done, unless it's dealt with, it doesn't exist. Then it becomes a memory or a photograph or a videotape.
The most immediately bereaved are the dancers. Typically for pioneers of modern dance, both Cunningham and Bausch founded companies which were named after them and danced only their works. They first choreographed for their own bodies, and their dancers often seem cast in their likeness. So the death of these choreographers is a particular crisis.
Is everybody here?
On the notice board of the Cunningham Studios in Manhattan, I saw a list of rules by John Cage, Merce's partner and collaborator. One rule says, always follow the leader.
All right, let's take places.
Robert Swinston is setting his watch to time a run-through.
All right, position.
He performed for Merce for 30 years.
Go.
The last 17 of which he was also his assistant.
Curtain coming up.
Merce's picture is up on the wall. And his desk is still there. And we have another picture of him there. We have plants and flowers there. And we light candles when we work. Of course, we miss him. You know, he was a leader. I'm very similar to him in a way. We call it studio rat, that we come to the studio every day. This is our home and where we work. The daily work, the process, is really our life. It's our lifeblood. So I'm trying to figure out a way to maintain the Cunningham studio, to teach Merce's technique, and also to teach his repertory.
Close. Either first or fifth back. Do you remember what you did? Did you close fifth?
It feels like fifth, but I can't say.
So I think so. Close fifth back and twist, holding the arms. Brush the left leg side with the arms going side high straight. Close fifth back.
To pass Merce's work on to this generation and then the next generation. And hopefully then this generation, who's learning it now, can develop their experience and take it to the three or four generations forward. This is how you pass dance from one generation to the other.
Have you ever considered just letting the dance evaporate?
I never considered that. Of course, I'm devoted to his work. I mean, dance should be seen. Dance is dance is a verb.
Pina Bausch forged theatre works out of material her dancers fed her, intimacies about trying to connect with each other and the world. She absorbed the dancers into her body, and they absorbed her.
Okay, quiet, please. We start.
Josephine Ann Endicott, who's Australian, joined Bausch's Wuppertal Tanztheater in 1973, the year it began.
You gave so much of yourself. You gave so many feelings to her. Sometimes I thought, I am her feelings. I've always wanted to leave that company, but now that she left us first, I've always wanted to have short hair. Not always, but over the last 10 years, because when you get over 50, people say old people shouldn't have long hair, but Pina wanted always Joe with long hair. I got a pair of scissors, and I took this part of my hair, the fringe, and started cutting. I had this in my hand. The tail of my handy rang. It was actually one of Pina's assistants. And the call was, Joe, Pina is dead. The scissors fell to the floor. I let the hair down and I couldn't cut any longer. So this, I don't know, it's a very bizarre connection to her through my hair. And I wanted to cut it and I was one chop away. And then that phone rang, so it's something very bizarre. I thought to myself, oh, now I can be free of her, now I can be free. And the next morning, I walked down to the beach, to the sea, and I started to swim into this big sea, and I started crying in the water and calling out, Pina, Pina.
I bring you back to a very practical question.
Yeah.
Who inherited the dancers?
The rights and all of that has the son of Pina, Rolf Solomon Bausch.
And does that matter? Will that affect things?
No, I don't think so. He will try and do what he thinks is right and what's best for the company. I don't know, he's maybe 24. It's a very nice boy, man, now. Yeah, we are in his hands. They have a Stiftung, a foundation. We're seeing, we're going from week to week, from month to month, and learning by doing.